Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 metre peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 8th of May, these are our main stories. The world's oceans have broken temperature records every day over the past year. Israel reopens one of the main aid crossings into Gaza, but thousands of people flee Rafah ahead of an expected ground incursion. A BBC investigation uncovers clear ties between members of Germany's AfD party and former neo-Nazi networks.
The AfD clearly states a political point of view, turning Germany into something that we've only seen between 1933 and 45.
Also in this podcast, how a peanut and milk allergy trial is transforming lives, and the man from Nepal dedicating his life to the conservation of owls. We start with a stark warning about the impact of climate change. The world's oceans have broken temperature records every single day over the past year. The BBC analysis is based on data from the European Union's Copernicus Climate Service. Nearly 50 days have smashed existing highs for the time of year by the largest margin in the satellite era. Justin Rowlatt is our climate editor.
It's a confirmation of something that we all knew, which is that the world has been going through this extraordinarily warm streak. As you say, every single day for an entire year has set a new daily average sea surface temperature record for that day. That is an extraordinary thing to happen. We're not inching past the previous records. We are really blasting through them. So on around 47 days, the existing high was exceeded by at least a third of a degree Celsius. Now, that may not sound much, but remember, this is an average across the seas and oceans of the entire world. So that is a huge margin. And it isn't just sea temperatures that have been incredibly high. It is also air temperatures. So this April 2024, was the warmest April ever recorded. That extends to 11 months, the successive months that have set new temperature records for that month. So, you know, there's a kind of cacophony of extraordinary global temperature records that are being broken, which tells us the ongoing impacts of climate change.
And Justin, just briefly, let's deal with what sceptics might say, is that they say, look, this coincides with the El Nino event, which warms the waters anyway. What do you say to that?
Well, that's absolutely right. Yes, it does. It's a strong El Nino. We're going out of it now, and that adds an extra kind of punch of energy, an extra punch of heat to the atmosphere, but against a background of ever-increasing global temperatures because of climate change. So the last big El Nino event was back in 2016. We saw new record temperatures set then, but we're now exceeding them in 2024, and that tells us that each time these El Ninos hit, global warming is driving average global temperatures up, and as I say, affecting sea temperatures all around the world. I'm in North Wales, and the populations of plants and animals here, a place that you consider temperate and pretty stable, are changing as a result of rising sea temperatures around the UK.
And we can hear now from Professor Ian Barber from the University of Aberystwyth in Wales, can't we?
There is a Japanese species of sea squirt. It's called a carpet sea squirt. They form a blanket, a carpet, if you like, over the seabed. They prevent the growth of native organisms in the areas that they colonise. Because they do so well in our environment, they can potentially take over huge areas of the seabed.
Justin, that's a very local impact. What are the broader impacts of these rapidly warming oceans, particularly on corals, things like that?
Yeah, the coral is a really tragic story. So it was announced a few weeks back that the world is experiencing a global mass coral bleaching event. Coral has a sort of symbiotic algae inside it, and when the sea temperatures get too high, it ejects that algae and goes white. That's why it's called bleaching, and can die as a result. So an incredible threat to global corals. And as people probably know, coral doesn't cover much of the seabed, but is an incredible source of biodiversity, home to a quarter of marine species. So that's the kind of tropical oceans affected. We're also seeing impacts in Antarctica and the Arctic. So in Antarctica, emperor penguins are struggling to breed on the ice because the ice is breaking away underneath them. So impacts all over the globe.
Justin Rowlatt. Talks to find a ceasefire in Gaza have restarted in Cairo, just as the Israeli military stepped up its bombing of the south of the territory. Conditions on the ground are getting worse for the tens of thousands of Gazans who've been ordered to leave the city of Rafah by the Israeli military. Speaking from there, Moses Kondowe of Project Hope, that's a humanitarian healthcare organisation, said their work had been affected by the closure of crossing points for aid.
We had a team of specialist surgeons who were supposed to cross from Cairo into Rafah to support some of the critical health facilities which are providing secondary emergency care for people who have been impacted by the war. But due to the security issues around the border crossings, all movements of the UN and aid agencies' convoys into Rafah were cancelled.
Israel has now announced one of the main crossing points has been reopened. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolan Nell, has just filed this report.
Plumes of smoke from Israeli airstrikes have been seen over Rafah and heavy gunfire has been heard. Israeli forces say they've killed what they call Hamas terrorists and destroyed tunnel shafts. To the east of the city, the Kerem Shalom crossing, a vital route for humanitarian supplies, was said to have been reopened by Israel earlier. It was closed on Sunday after Hamas rocket fire killed four Israeli soldiers nearby. However, the aid agency UNRWA says no aid has yet entered Gaza. Talks to try to reach a new deal on a ceasefire and the return of hostages are continuing in Cairo, with the US saying it believes a revised Hamas proposal could lead to a breakthrough. And the Israeli military has played down the significance of Washington halting a shipment of powerful bombs, saying its support in the war has been unprecedented.
Yolan Nell. An appeals court in Hong Kong has banned a popular song written during the pro-democracy protests of 2019. Well, that is the song. It's called Glory to Hong Kong, and it includes defiant lyrics, including the key protest slogan, Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times. After today's court ruling, the territory's authorities have tried to have that song removed from the internet. Our Asia Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, told me more.
This is the end of a legal case which began last year when the government in Hong Kong applied for an injunction to have this song banned. Initially, a judge refused to agree to that request. The government has appealed, and that appeal has decided that the government was correct all along and that they can have the song banned. In effect, though, it's already illegal to listen, to play, to disseminate this song in Hong Kong. It has been for a couple of years. What the government has done is used other laws and regulations in order to have it quashed so nobody can hear it. Just for example, last year they actually prosecuted a busker who was playing it. So it already has been banned, but this one, this legal ruling just kind of ties up the loose ends.
And if it was played in public again now by a busker, by a radio station, what could happen? Prosecution, what kind of punishment?
Yeah, prosecution. I think the major impact this particular ruling will have, as you indicated there in your introduction, will be that although in Hong Kong it was difficult to hear the song, already difficult, it was still available on the internet. And so I think the authorities in Hong Kong wanted this ruling to give them more legal backing in order to force internet providers like Google to try to get rid of this song on the internet, because there have been a number of really embarrassing incidents in which this song has been played at international events instead of China's national anthem, and organizers have sometimes just pulled the song off the internet mistakenly thinking it was the national anthem of Hong Kong. So I think the authorities were keen particularly to just stop that particular avenue for the song. But it gives you an indication really of just how far Hong Kong has changed, how much the authorities are prepared to do in order to stop what many people would be consider free speech. Because in effect, what they have done is just banned a piece of music.
Mickey Bristow. Parents of children with potentially life-threatening milk and peanut allergies say their lives have been transformed by a three-year-old trial led by researchers in the UK. It found that children's immune systems can be trained to cope with small amounts of the allergen if they were given tiny daily doses. It's hoped that eventually this method may be able to replace pharmaceutical supplements that are normally used to treat food allergies. Doctors say they are already seeing children able to consume and tolerate the very foods which previously would have triggered a severe allergic reaction. 11-year-old Thomas has been taking part in the study.
It's changed my life. It's been managing my allergy and building my tolerance up to the best I can. I've been taking 6 peanut M&Ms.
Here's Thomas's mother, Lauren.
It's brought down our anxiety levels around food, and knowing that Thomas can now tolerate 6 peanuts a day has taken away some of that worry and hopefully mean that he'll be able to eat a wider variety of food, as we won't be so concerned around accidental exposure and the anxiety around Thomas going to parties, sleepovers, when he's not with us. This has really, really helped to reduce that. And to do this without any medicine, just off-the-shelf products, is truly amazing.
Children as young as 2 were amongst the participants in the trial, which was funded by the Natasha Foundation, set up by the parents of a 15-year-old girl who died after eating a sandwich which contained sesame seed, to which she had an allergy. Hassan Arshad is a professor of allergy and clinical immunology at the University of Southampton in the UK. He told Johnny Diamond more about the study.
We assess how much a child can tolerate, which is generally very, very small amount, right, like 10 milligram. And then we built it up, gradually increasing the dose over a period of 6 to 8 months until they can tolerate a maximum dose, which is, as Thomas said, around 5 to 6 peanut M&Ms, which gives them sufficient tolerance to go around and eat freely.
Now, this doesn't cure the allergy. I mean, people are still allergic to things, but it enables them to live with it. Is that a fair summary?
To some extent, there are varying degrees of responses in individual. So some people can tolerate the maximum amount, or rather unlimited. Others do start to react at some stage where we stop. Essentially, in about 80 to 90% of children giving this treatment, they are able to tolerate sufficient food that allows them to basically eat freely and do not have the worry of these accidental exposure and reactions, which is what they have previously lived with.
80 to 90% is, it seems like an astonishing success rate.
Exactly. This treatment has been found to be extremely effective if given in the way that we have designed the protocol. And importantly, it needs to be safe, because these children have been previously reacting to the food. And doing this does have some risks associated with it. Yeah. And therefore, we have designed a program with scientists who have been doing this before to develop this as a safe and also effective.
It's worth doing a quick don't try this at home warning, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. So at the end of this project, we hope to develop detailed guidance as how this can be done under medical supervision in future, and the programme can be rolled out.
Professor Hassan Arshad from the University of Southampton in the UK. Still to come, Russia's last Eurovision contestant says that despite the threat to her safety, she'll continue to call for peace in Ukraine.
I believe that with music, it's a little bit easier to go through this pain to go for this path of life with a warm heart.
Now to the Serbian capital, Belgrade. Where the Chinese President Xi Jinping was met by dancers and musicians in traditional costumes at the start of the latest leg of his European tour. His visit to the Balkan country comes 25 years since NATO bombed the Chinese embassy there during its campaign to try to force the then Yugoslav forces to withdraw from Kosovo. NATO said that was an accident, but it damaged US-Chinese relations for years. I asked our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay, who's in Belgrade, why this visit is so important to Serbia and to China.
I think to China it gives it an opportunity to have this platform to criticise NATO, because if you want a sympathetic audience when you're criticising NATO, well, Serbia is a very good place to come. Belgrade was bombed in that 1999 campaign, as were many other places in Serbia and Montenegro. And I think support here for Serbia joining NATO, as most of its neighbours have done, is somewhere in the low single figures. So that's an obvious thing for China to do. In terms of what we're looking at here with China and Serbia, the two presidents meeting, it's also a very strong signal that Serbia, while it's deep in EU accession negotiations, sees those talks dragging out interminably, and it's sending a message to Brussels saying, look, we've got other friends and they're quite powerful as well.
And Guy, that 25-year anniversary, how is it going to be marked?
Well, we were wondering whether Mr. Xi might go to what is now called the China Cultural Centre, which is a new building established on the site of the embassy, and that's having its official opening. Now, we haven't seen him go there yet, and he's got a fairly compact itinerary, so he may not arrive. Nonetheless, there's that memorial outside the China Cultural Centre, and Mr. Xi has marked the anniversary by writing an editorial in one of Serbia's biggest newspapers, saying that China will never forget, and that while Chinese people cherish peace, they will never allow such tragic history to be repeated.
So after this visit to Serbia, President Xi goes on to Hungary. I suppose no surprise there, because he's going to get a similarly welcome reaction there, isn't it?
Well, indeed, China is the biggest investor in Hungary. BYD, the Chinese electric car company, is about to open a factory there. And, of course, Budapest is at the other end of the Belgrade-Budapest railway, which is being built with Chinese finance and Chinese engineering expertise. So all in all, it fits very nicely indeed for President Xi Jinping, not just sending a message that aspirant EU members want to have strong relations with China, but the current EU member states do as well.
Guy Delaunay in Belgrade. A senior member of Germany's intelligence agencies says the far-right Alternative for Deutschland party poses a risk to democracy. The AfD, which has strong support in eastern Germany, rejects accusations of extremism. But the BBC has found clear links between significant party figures and extremist or even former neo-Nazi networks. More details from our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker.
On a Sunday morning, the church bells rang on longer than usual in the city of Cottbus. Alternative for Deutschland activists, who'd set up a stage right by the church, suspected the local priest of trying to interrupt their rally. But the speeches do get going, including by 27-year-old Jean-Pascal Homme, a regional parliamentary candidate for the far-right AfD. But as the BBC has found, he's held links with several groups now classed by domestic intelligence as extremist, networks accused of anti-migrant, anti-Muslim ideology.
All these organizations focus on one subject, which is the main theme of our times. It is the population replacement going on in Germany and in Europe. To voice that and to fight that politically is not extremist. It means defending the right to our homeland as Germans and Europeans.
I'm on a quiet street in the city of Cottbus, and I'm looking across at a local office. And it's in that building that Jean-Pascal Homme helped organise a meeting in March that we've been looking into. The speaker was an MP called Matthias Helferich, who once described himself as the friendly face of National Socialism, Nazism. The old leaked Facebook messages, says Matthias Helfrich, were satire, but they led to him not being able to join the AfD's parliamentary faction.
Remigration is the political vision of Deutschland.
His talk in Cottbus was on remigration, a term widely regarded as a euphemism for mass deportations. In a video here, Mr. Helfrich talks about preserving the land of the Germans and remigrating people from Africa and the Middle East in their millions.
Remigration. Millionenfache Remigration.
Why does this matter? Well, first of all, the AfD is hoping to do well in European parliamentary and regional German elections this year. And these men who we discovered were all at this one meeting back in March aren't the only examples of alleged extremism in the party. What's more, particularly within the more radical wing of the AfD, these guys aren't nobodies. They have influence. I've met with a domestic intelligence chief in the eastern state of Thuringia. Stefan Kramer, who's Jewish, says he'd leave Germany if the AfD gained power.
By your saying that as the head of domestic intelligence here, doesn't that feed into their narrative that the state is somehow biased against them, even persecuting them?
Look, this is not about bias. The AfD clearly states in the meantime a Völkisch nationalistic political point of view, turning Germany back into something that we've probably only seen between 1933 and 45.
The AfD claims it's being smeared by the establishment as it works to drum up momentum at rallies and town hall events. Polling high in Germany's east, supporters even claim they're not extreme, but increasingly represent the centre ground.
Jessica Parker reporting. Manija was once one of Russia's biggest pop stars. She's also the last person to have represented the country at the Eurovision Song Contest back in 2021. But when Russia invaded Ukraine, Manija decided to use her name and her platform to share her anti-war views. From that moment, her concerts were cancelled, her songs were banned, and her safety, both in real life and online, compromised. More than 2 years since the start of the war, Manija is using her music to share a message of hope to those affected by the conflict.
I was a refugee before, but then became a big star in Russia. You know, I did it by my own hands with my mother. It was absolutely independent way, without any labels, without any, supporters with money. We did it, two women together. I remember that morning when I saw all of the news that war started in Ukraine, and I had so many flashbacks in my head. It's horrible to be a refugee. It's horrible to experience that in your life. When I said I want, to see peace, I think it's a normal thing to do. I know it's risky, and I'm risking a lot right now. I lost my career. I didn't lose my career. My government is trying to destroy my career in my home. That's okay. I'm continuing my way. I'm doing what I can. War is going on still. And there are so many women and kids. The only one thing they want is to come back home. And they can't. I know that feeling. And I wanted to support all of those people. I wanted to show them that they are not alone. And we have to think about them. Because even if tomorrow war will stop, I wish, I really want it, there still will be lots of refugees. And we have to be their supporter of their bright future. I'm blacklisted right now. Like, my music banned in public places. Children in school cannot listen to my music. I cannot do, charity performances. I'm going through cyberbullying attacks. All of my media platforms, social media platforms are attacked by, bots. I'm going through... right now, under the investigation from a Russian investigative committee. Sometimes I feel myself very weak and helpless. But at the same time, I understand that, first of all, I'm not alone. I have my family and I have my daughter, and that, which means that I have to continue my way, And, I don't want to look like a victim. I'm still a human, and I'm singing, and I'm a woman. and I can do what I love to do. I'm writing my songs to give people hope. I believe that with music, it's a little bit easier to go through this pain, to go through this path of life with a warm heart.
That was the singer Manija. How can a group of closely related birds be regarded simultaneously as unlucky, the protection from evil, an ally to the farmer, a pest to be eliminated with a catapult, an endangered species worth preserving, and a symbol of wisdom and a bird worth eating? Well, that is the fate of Nepal's 23 owl species. There's a wide range of threats to Nepal's owls. 1,500 of them are hunted or traded illicitly every year. But one man is trying to protect them all. He's called Raju Acharya. He's just received an award from the Whitley Fund for Nature. That's a UK charity helping conservationists in the global south. Sir David Attenborough, a veteran nature broadcaster, is one of its supporters.
Nepal is famous for its breathtaking landscapes, from the tallest snow-peaked mountains to its lush green forests. But as the sun goes down, a whole other world is revealed, along with a group of birds that has captured the heart of one man. Raju's approach to conservation gives even the smallest communities the power to influence how a whole nation protects its biodiversity.
Sean Lay asked Raju Acharya about the challenge to conservation posed by the owl's ambiguous status in Nepal.
In Nepal, the owl are not considered as good bird, but our lifestyle is totally dependent on the subsistence agriculture. And these owls, they regulate the rodent population. That's why they help the farmer. So this is one of the major benefit. That's why this bird is also called as farmer's friend.
So it's a farmer's friend because it does good work on the land. Can you explain a bit more about how the owl helps the farmer?
A single family of owl, like a barn owl, which is also common here as well. So they eat around 2,000 rodent in one season. So you can just imagine how much they are helping to farmer. That's why in many countries, the government is trying to provide the artificial nest so that lots of owl can come and they control the rodent population, even in England, in South Africa. But we don't have such program. So they help farmer to get more agriculture crop.
And yet in Nepal, they're not necessarily regarded as a beneficial bird. A lot of people see them as a pest.
We have around 125 ethnic group and languages. So it is very hard to generalize the people's perception. But in general, the people, they don't like owl, and they symbolize owl as a very lazy and dumb creature. So they are not considered very good. But it depends. If we go a little bit up in the highland, then people believe that their body parts are work as a protector. So they keep the feather of the owl in the main entrance, and they believe that the ghost and evil never go inside the home. The house is protected. So it depends.
Your work, and this is partly why you've won this prize, is because this charity encourages conservation that works with communities and tries to change perceptions in communities. How hard has that been to do?
It's very difficult because the landscape of Nepal is so hard to reach from one place to another place. Even I had already visited many area. But it's very difficult, and the people have such kind of perception since long here, you know.
Yes. So they've grown up with these beliefs.
Yeah, they've grown up with the same perception. So it's very hard. So we try to teach them the importance of owl. We try to teach them. Some people in Nepal, they regarded owl as an envoy of the goddess Lakshmi, which is the god of wealth, you know. So we just share the information. If you kill the owl, it means you are killing the god.
Yes.
So in this way, we try to find out some very critical points.
Yes.
And we share those points.
So you're tailoring your message according to your audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It depends on the audience.
I wonder where your personal love of owls comes from. Is it something from your childhood? Is it something that's developed as you've developed your interest in conservation? When did you fall in love with owls?
One day I was walking in the village, and I found in the village some people, some young people, they were doing open barbecue of strange bird, you know. And when I asked them, and they said it's an owl. It's for just a supporting material for the alcohol, you know. So at that time, I was just blown away because I didn't expect it. Mm. People also heal the owl and eat the owl. That was my turning point. And I thought that let's start something. Mm. Otherwise, it will be very late for the conservation.
That was Raju Acharya, the winner of the 2024 Whitley Award for his owl conservation efforts. And before him, you also heard from David Attenborough, 98 years old today and still fighting for the protection of the natural world. And before we go, the Olympic torch has arrived in France. The flame travelled in style as it sailed into the port town of Marseille on a 19th century ship. It arrived to the claps and cheers of sports fans ready to welcome the iconic Olympic flame. Well, it now begins its epic journey across France, taking in some vineyards in the Loire on the way and the world-famous Lascaux caves with their prehistoric paintings. It'll then head overseas again to six of France's overseas territories, including Guadeloupe in the Caribbean and French Polynesia in the Pacific. It will ultimately make its way back to the host city, Paris, where the Games are due to start on July the 26th. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sid Dundon, and the producers were Vanessa Heaney and Lucy Acheson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.